This week on the Best of Flashpoints. A new congressional report says it's likely there will be a nuclear or biological attack during Obama's presidency, as the crisis between the nuclear-armed states of India and Pakistan intensifies. An eyewitness with the Michigan Peace Team reports on an upsurge of settler violence in occupied Palestine. On the Block Report, an interview with political hip-hop musician Boots Riley of The Coup. And the Night Report, Dennis Bernstein, Nora Barros-Friedman, J.R., and Robert Knight. They're all coming up straight ahead on Flashpoint. Stay tuned. And now from exile in New York City, the Night Report with Robert Knight.
In today's Night Report, Mumbai. I'm Robert Knight in New York. India summoned the Pakistani ambassador after at least 10 men laid siege to the coastal city of Mumbai, killing approximately 200 in the course of a four-day commando siege that has left the two nations on the verge of new confrontations. Also, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is tonight en route to India from a NATO meeting for consultations on the attack, which threatens to set back not only Indo-Pakistani relations, but to tilt the dynamics of the U.S.-led war of occupation in Afghanistan. India has blamed Pakistan for what Islamabad says were non-governmental elements who allegedly trained in Pakistan for a guerrilla assault on behalf of Muslim autonomists in the disputed northern border region of Kashmir. Blame is being placed on the Kashmiri autonomous movement Laskar-e-Taiba, which denied involvement in the attack. LET was originally founded with the assistance of the CIA-linked Pakistani ISI spy agency, but it has been officially outlawed in Pakistan for the past 6 years. According to the latest information available, at least 10 Fedayeen, described by local police as speaking Hindi with Punjabi accents, made an amphibious landing Wednesday night at the Banking and Resort Center of Mumbai, previously known as Bombay. The assault team, well-trained and heavily armed with grenades and AK-47 assault rifles, took a charter cruise to Mumbai from Karachi, Pakistan. But that route was diverted mid-course to a hijacked fishing trawler, where the perpetrators sought to avoid capture by the Indian Navy. That following Indian intelligence monitoring of their ongoing satellite cell phone consultations with Pakistani-based coordinators. The assault team killed the four-member crew of the fishing trawler and abandoned it for speedboats as they approached Mumbai's shore. But not without leaving behind maps and cell phones with global satellite positioning records and phone logs that were conveniently retrieved by Indian naval officials. During the course of their assault on two hotels, a restaurant, a train station, and a Jewish cultural center, the attackers took advantage of the slow and lackluster response of Indian military teams, detonating explosives, tossing grenades, spraying crowds, booby-trapping corpses, and committing executions that have so far resulted in a death toll that at last count was approaching 200 fatalities. Among the as yet unresolved details are reports that during the guerrilla landing, two speedboats fled after dropping off the 10 point men, and Indian intelligence reports that the attacker's ship from Karachi appeared to contain personal belongings, including jackets and toothbrushes for 15 people, not only the 10 reported to have conducted the multi-point attacks in Mumbai. Also unresolved is whether the landing party had local support for the well-researched attack strategy, and whether the discovery of maps with escape routes implies that the attackers may not have assumed that they were on a suicide mission. The most primary tactical details emerged from two sources, a telephone interview with a pair of guerrillas and the alleged testimony of the 1 in 10 whom Indian authorities claim was captured alive. In a live interview broadcast Friday, an attacker calling himself Shahadullah claimed to be from Hyderabad in India, representing what he called the Deccan Mujahideen, a geographic reference to southern India. He also recalled Muslim rage over the destruction several years ago of the Babri Mosque by Hindu nationalists, which resulted in riots and the subsequent deaths of 2,000 Indian Muslims. During that live interview from the Oberoi Hotel, the attacker demanded the release of all Muslim Mujahideen imprisoned in India in exchange for a false promise of hostage releases. The other source of direct testimony comes from a 21-year-old man, alias Assam or Ajmal Amir Kassab, whom officials say trained in Pakistan-occupied Kashmir for 5 months. Kassab was also quoted as saying, "There were 24 of us who took one-year training in camps organized by Laskhar-e-Taiba at Mansehra and Muzaffarabad in Punjab province of Pakistan. 10 of us were later handpicked for the operation in Mumbai," quote, "where the attackers made an early orientation visit." He said that he was instructed to kill 5,000 people or, quote, "fight until the last breath," end quote, before concluding that, quote, "I have done right, I have no regrets," end quote. At last word, Kassab was on a hunger strike and calling for his own execution. As the inquiries continued on Indian security procedures and the deep identities and allegiances of the attackers, the week's events have already had a major geostrategic effect. Pakistan's Prime Minister Yousuf Gilani has told Washington and NATO that 100,000 Pakistani troops deployed near Afghanistan will be moved to the Indian border if tensions escalate, creating a nuclear-edge confrontation that could radically alter President-elect Barack Obama's plan for heightened intervention in western Pakistan as part of the escalating NATO-American occupation. Obama has now been presented with a military fait accompli, facing treacherous alternatives whether he moves eastward or westward in his Pakistani geostrategic initiative, or to the left or further rightward in his transitional appointments and national security policy. From Exile in New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoints.
If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning, I'd hammer in the evening.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to go to occupied Palestine in the West Bank and have a visit with Judith Carlson. Listen to this.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our focus on Palestine. As two teenage Palestinian boys were killed by U.S.-made Israeli helicopter gunships in the southern Gazan city of Rafah yesterday, armed Jewish-Israeli settlers continued their ongoing ground attacks in cities across the occupied West Bank. 28-year-old Amir Abdin, a Palestinian journalist, was stoned by armed Israeli settlers in the city of Hebron. And earlier today, a Palestinian man was stabbed 3 times in the back by an ultra-Orthodox Jewish settler in Jerusalem. Joining us to talk about the current situation regarding violent attacks against Palestinians in the West Bank, Jerusalem, and Gaza is Judith Carlson. Carlson is a member of the Michigan Peace Team, a global organization that sends activists into areas of potential violence and crisis, and specifically in Palestine to accompany Palestinian children to school and shepherds to fields that are under attack by Israeli settler and military forces. Judith, thank you so much for being with us today on Flashpoints.
Well, thank you so much.
So first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you are right now, and what you've been documenting the last few days.
Well, we started out in September in the southern part of the West Bank, south of Hebron in Etwani, with some of the Bedouin families that are living in caves there. We moved north, and for the last about 3 weeks, I've been helping with olive harvest, where the settlers are coming down and interfering with Palestinians harvesting their olives. And I was in Haifa tonight with a group of Palestinians that were protesting the siege in Gaza.
Well, Judith, let's talk a little bit about the situation in the West Bank. You've been to Jayus and several other villages under siege in the past week. Can you set the scene a little bit and tell us a little more about what's going on right now in these places.
We were in Jayus, which is a small village, right against the wall. And when I say the wall, I mean it's an 8-meter-high concrete divider or apartheid wall. It's segregating the land, the livelihood, the crops, and the businesses of a village. Jayus is cut in this and circled by this dividing area. There are about 6 artesian wells that have been divided from the village, and that's what the people have needed for water. So about 3 weeks ago, they began staging demonstrations. And the first demonstration that we went to started out very peacefully. We were progressing down the road, and before we really got out of the village, the Israeli military lined up across the road and stopped everyone. They had guns, of course, and tear gas. But in this case, everyone was so close to them that they really couldn't use the tear gas. And they couldn't use the concussion bombs without interfering with their own people. So as we were standing and talking to them, I'm short, I'm only 5 feet tall, and I realized that they were looking right over my head. So I just sort of inched around them, and a couple of the other women that had their children with them walked right by them, and they were concentrating on more of the action in the back. Some of the other villagers realized that they could simply take a side street and go around them. And at one point, the military realized that they were now surrounded by the demonstration, and they became very, very anxious. They broke ranks and started walking out of the village toward what they felt was a safer position. So the women and I just began following them right on their heels. And by the time they got close to their jeep down the road, the women and I had linked arms. These were all Palestinian women in headscarves and djellaba, and we were right behind them. When they turned around, I think they were expecting angry Palestinians screaming at them, and what they saw was a group of mature women. And it was just a simply priceless look on their faces because they didn't know how to react. And they told us to disperse and told us to leave, and we didn't. And we really could, I'm not fluent in Arabic, and they couldn't speak English, but there was somehow just an understanding between us. And we simply stood our ground and stood there. And after about 40 minutes, we heard a military jeep gunning its engine behind us as though it were going to ram us. And everybody looked at one another and refused to move. And so at this point, more internationals were backing us up. There were more women. And I began speaking very quietly to the soldiers and telling them to relax, that nobody was going to hurt them, that we were there completely peacefully, simply to express our dissatisfaction with the fact that these people could not get to their land, could not get through that gate, and that they wanted to work their land, they wanted to go to the greenhouses, and they couldn't. There's no way for them to live. There's no way for them to get any money, to get anything. They're completely cut off from everything they need to live. So after, I'd say almost an hour, when nobody could move, the military started forcing us back, and the people behind us simply stood their ground so that we were crushed between both groups. When they started leaning into the women, I started yelling, haram, haram, which means forbidden, forbidden. You can't touch the women. And they immediately jumped back. So when nothing was happening and the jeep couldn't get through, one of the women looked at me and smiled, and we all sat down. And it was so reminiscent of 60s sit-ins. We sat there on the ground in the dirt with the rocks and waited. And we sat there, I think the whole thing lasted about 3 hours, at which point the municipality brought in a loudspeaker and said that we had accomplished the resistance, and they felt that we had done everything we needed to do. We got up and we left. There was no gunfire. There were no bullets. It was totally peaceful. It was exactly what Gandhi had envisioned, only it was Palestine. And it was just an incredible, incredible experience. It was to see those women empowered and sitting there in front of the men, not, you know, culturally very often the women are behind the men, but not today. They were sitting there in front of the men. They had stopped the army. They had stopped the jeeps. And they had made their point without any violence at all.
Let me just tell people that we are speaking with Judith Carlson. She's with the Michigan Peace Team, and she's based in the occupied West Bank. She's doing accompaniment work there. Judith, go on. Tell us about what else you've been doing.
Okay, the second week when we went back, we had hoped to repeat exactly what had happened, but the demonstrations started after mid-morning prayers, and by the time our group got there, the demonstrators had gone all the way down the road to the wall, got to the gate, and there were no military there at all. There was no one guarding the gate. There's always military there, and it was deserted. And so apparently from video and that I've seen and from reports, what happened is someone climbed on the fence, which has electrical sensors but is not an electric fence, and opened the gate and destroyed some of the razor wire, opened the razor wire to access their fields. This alerted the military. The military came. And the response was excessive and out of balance to what had been done. By the time we got there, it was like a B-movie with just a cloud of tear gas, Palestinians running down the road, the military following, and we were standing there. They were shooting rubber-coated steel bullets, tear gas everywhere. And at the conclusion, they declared it apparently a closed military zone. We were all told to leave, and we went to the municipality offices. On the way, we met a Palestinian man who was trying to get three women home through the curfew area, and the military wouldn't let these women go home. So he asked for accompaniment, and that's what we are here to do, is to accompany people who need help. So he got in the car, and as we were taking the women home, a military jeep stopped us. One of the women with me and I were arrested because they said that we had no business to be in the area. And we explained to them that we were just, you know, we were not doing anything that was illegal. All we wanted to do was help these women to get home from work. And they kept us there for more than 3 hours. There was also a young Palestinian man there. They handcuffed him behind his back and blindfolded him and forced him to sit on the side of the road. We were then taken to Qalqilia checkpoint, which is about 15 minutes away. And we waited there for another half hour while the police talked to the army. They had our passports, and there was nowhere we could go. We were surrounded by soldiers with guns who were very angry at us. We ended up being taken to the Ariel Settlement police station. There were five internationals arrested. We were individually interrogated for anywhere from 15 minutes to 2 hours, depending on how compliant the person was. About 1:15 in the morning, they brought me in, and they started to threaten me with arrest, with detaining me in jail. This was a Friday night. They said that because of the Sabbath, there would be no one there to even speak to me until Sunday, that I was going to be deported. They wanted me to sign conditions. First, they wanted me to sign something in Hebrew that I couldn't read. They refused to give me a copy or a photocopy of the statement, and I said I would sign nothing. Being very polite. I said, I've given you more than an hour and a half. And I just very quietly began meditating and sitting there quietly doing a mantra and mumbling some quiet prayers. And he said, that's enough. And he threw my passport at me and told me to go home. It was then 3 o'clock in the morning. It was about 12 hours that they had detained us. And I said nothing and went home. The third week in J-Use, they refused to let internationals in at all. They closed the entire area, and they tried. They've tried everything they can to shut down any kind of peaceful demonstration, any kind of resistance to the occupation. Very heavy-handed.
Finally, Judith, we're going into a new phase of another capitalist, imperialist administration here in the States. Obama has just picked Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, which means that she will essentially pick up where Condoleezza Rice left off. What are your deepest concerns about the new American administration with Clinton, who's a devout AIPAC supporter and genuine friend to Israeli politics and policies, now set to spearhead Palestine-Israeli peace talks?
You know, at this point, from what I've seen here in the last 3 months, I've been writing blogs, I've been sending information home to people, and I wonder if anybody, any politician, anyone can understand what the people here feel unless they walk through a checkpoint, unless the guns are pointed at them, unless they experience what Palestinians go through. I just don't know how anyone in the United States, coming from the privilege that we have, how we can ever really understand and feel compassion for people that have spent decades in this kind of occupation with this kind of oppression. I just really have very little faith that the United States can be objective enough to be a partner in peace here. And I really hope that other nations that are maybe not as entrenched and not as economically involved in the situation, I hope they will take the lead, because I don't see how anyone in the United States, unless they come and do what I've done. I mean, I came here to spend time here with these people because I knew from my experiences in the United States I'd never understand, and I can't believe a politician can understand.
Where can people go to follow your work with the Michigan Peace Team and read some of your writing?
Well, if you'd like, you can go to mptinpalestine.blogspot.com.
Judith Carlson, please be safe, and thank you so much for all the work that you're doing there in the occupied West Bank.
Thank you so much for putting the focus on it. We really need more people with an objective understanding looking at this. Thank you so much for your work.
A 100,000 people were living their lives. Grandparents, children, fathers and wives. Now they're just shadows on the street. In such a quick burst of incredible heat. Now listen to them talk about doing it again. From whence came the souls of these terrible men? Hiroshima. 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 Hiroshima.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. With the recent attacks in Mumbai, the old rivalry between nuclear powers Pakistan and India has been rekindle, to say the least. India is already pointing the finger at Pakistan and threatening, in diplomatic terms, to take military action if, in fact, Pakistan is not seen to be cooperating in the investigation into the recent attacks in Mumbai. Of course, underlying this rivalry is the fact that both countries have dozens of potentially devastating nuclear weapons. In fact, this is one of the key flashpoints that concern anti-nuclear activists, anti-proliferation activists around the world. Meanwhile, Congress has just released a report predicting that a biological or nuclear attack is likely to occur somewhere around the globe during the Obama administration or shortly thereafter. Joining us to talk about living under a nuclear hair trigger is Jacqueline Cabasso. Cabasso is the executive director of the Western States Legal Foundation and has been monitoring nuclear policy for years. She is the recipient of the Sean McBride Peace Prize. She joins us in the studio. Welcome back, Jackie, and congratulations on the award.
Thank you, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you with us, and I'm going to ask you to lean right into the mic.
Okay.
And let's begin by your concerns. We've seen this flare up again between India and Pakistan. We know that both have nuclear weapons. Tell us about how dangerous that nuclear relationship is.
Well, it's of great concern because the India and Pakistan share a very long common border. India is believed to have about 100 nuclear warheads, Pakistan about 60. The two countries have had at least four major military conflicts since 1947. The most recent one in 1999, there were at least 13 implicit or explicit nuclear threats. And because of the close proximity and the state of their technological development, the missile launch time would be under 10 minutes. That means it's under 10 minutes of decision-making time. And as a former Pakistani general said in a 2000 interview, once the conventional war breaks out, fog of war sets in. During the war, you have deceptions, you have misperception, you have communication breakdowns, things heat up. So that's the situation. It's not going to start with a nuclear exchange, but given the historical enmity and all of the different factors at play there now, any conflict could escalate to a nuclear exchange, and that would be absolutely devastating. The Natural Resources Defense Council has estimated that at least 22 million South Asians would die from radiation released in any kind of exchange, and plus untold thousands more in from the blast. So, I mean, nuclear weapons are really serious business, and I think that they get discussed in some ways very casually, in some ways in a in terms of states having them, it seems to be if they're in responsible hands, it's nothing to worry about. And if they're in the wrong hands, then they become weapons of mass destruction. But all nuclear weapons are weapons of mass destruction.
All right. In the context of, say, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, remembering that the United States is still the only power to use nuclear weapons on a civilian population or civilian populations, how do these, you say India 100 weapons, Pakistan 60, what kind of weapons are these?
Well, the U.S. nuclear weapons that devastated Hiroshima and Nagasaki were actually prototypes. They weren't tested. They were, by today's standards, small atomic bombs, and they had a kiloton yield of 12 to 15 kilotons. They killed about, incinerated approximately 200,000 people, those two bombs. And, of course, there are lasting radiation health effects that still are not fully understood.
These were civilian bombings. Well,
right.
What do these new ones look like?
Now, India and Pakistan, you know, I really don't know the makeup of their arsenals, but they are certainly at least as powerful as the Hiroshima A bombs, and I believe that the most recent tests in 1998 may have involved trying to develop thermonuclear hydrogen bombs.
Wow. And all right, so they both have these weapons. How did India get its 100 nuclear weapons?
India started its nuclear program in the 1970s through the Atoms for Peace program. They were supplied with research reactors and materials by the United States and Canada. They also have their own uranium, and they were able to develop a uranium enrichment capability. Pakistan, which is going to be your next question, actually developed their program completely indigenously and through clandestine networks under the direction of AQ Khan.
All right. And what role does Israel play in the arming, in the nuclear arming of India?
I am not aware that Israel plays any role in India's nuclear armament, but the two countries do share a strategic and increasing strategic relationship, and India is currently Israel's biggest buyer of arms and weapons systems generally. The other thing that the three countries have involved is that they are all nuclear weapons states, and they all remain outside the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty.
And Israel has... what,
two, three hundred weapons. And modern delivery systems.
And you say outside the parameters. So, like, everybody's focusing on Iran, that, and they've already been having visits and cooperating with international...
Iran was one of the first non-nuclear weapon states to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty when it opened for signature in 1970. And it is subject to International Atomic Energy Agency inspections of its civilian nuclear program, and right up until now, today, I can tell you that the IAEA has not found any evidence of any diversion of nuclear materials from their civilian nuclear program. Of course, the United States and some of its allies are continue to accuse Iran of harboring a secret nuclear weapons program hidden under its civilian nuclear program, but there is no evidence of that. Now, that's not to say that Iran could not make the decision at some point in the future to establish a nuclear weapons program, as could any other country with advanced nuclear power technology. But the point is that there's no evidence that they're doing that now. They have a right under the NPT to have this civilian nuclear technology, and they are being, I believe, singled out in a very egregious way when there are a number of other countries who have even greater capabilities, and that would be, ironically enough, Japan at the top of the list, which has tons of separated plutonium.
So given what you're saying, we don't have a ton of time, but all this attention on Iran, when you've got India and Pakistan, who have a very powerful rivalry, and each with mighty powerful nuclear weapons, and not really participating within the international monitors in the framework, I guess we've been looking in the wrong spot.
Well, there are many spots that we've to look at. I mean, we really were jerked around by the so-called axis of evil. And I like to sort of say, imagine, you know, that you have a piece of paper with three holes cut out, like a piece of Swiss cheese, and you lay it over the globe, and you're only looking at those three countries in terms of nuclear rogue, quote-unquote, states. There are 44 states altogether with some degree or other of nuclear capabilities, and it's a matter of weeks, months, or years in each case in terms of if they decided that they wanted to go for a nuclear weapons program. So it really needs to be addressed as a global problem, and the biggest violator of the NPT is the United States. Okay?
The leading proliferator,
because it is the United States, as the first and only country that has used nuclear weapons so far, thank God. It is obligated and has been obligated since 1970 to negotiate in good faith the elimination of its nuclear arsenal and the end of the arms race at an early date. Now, that also applies to Russia, the UK, France, and China, and they're all not doing it. But the United States is leading the way not doing it, modernizing its nuclear arsenal. We have now a brand new Air Force roadmap for a reinvigorated nuclear weapons enterprise for the 21st century, which is actually like a 150-page PR plan for how they're going to, you know, keep their position. We've got the nuclear weapons establishment, the research and development infrastructure, getting a massive infusion of cash to modernize itself through the complex transformation plan. And now we have Gates, who is being extended as Secretary of Defense, who is advocating very strenuously for development of a new nuclear warhead.
So the new/old Secretary of Defense hasn't really seen a nuclear weapon he doesn't like.
Well,
maybe he's seen a few.
He says, and what's scary about this is that it very much echoes Obama's line, which Obama's second line. Obama's first line is, I will lead the world away from nuclear weapons, or I will lead towards a nuclear weapons-free world. But as long as nuclear weapons exist, we will maintain a robust nuclear deterrent. And Gates is saying, as long as other countries have nuclear weapons, we must maintain a robust nuclear
deterrent. And we'll keep selling them to them
and
to make
so
sure they have them.
It's kind of, right. At the same time, Obama just said yesterday, I am committed to maintaining the world's strongest military. Now, you cannot ever get rid of nuclear weapons globally if you have overwhelming conventional superiority and other countries seek to, who feel themselves to be in the enemy's list, feel that they need some kind of parity. The Russians call it strategic stability. That's why they are now modernizing their nuclear arsenal. And around and around and around it goes.
So we only have 30 seconds, but there's a report coming out of Congress. They say nuclear or biological attack, confrontation within the Obama administration or soon thereafter. What do you think of that report? Does it make you nervous?
No, it doesn't. I think it's fear-mongering. It makes me mad, actually. I think that it's coming out in a very calculated time, in a very calculated way. I think that the dangers of a nuclear weapons use by a state, including the United States, are much higher than the possibility of use by acquisition or use by terrorists. And what makes me maddest of all is that in its recommendations, it talks only about non-proliferation, that is, stopping other countries from acquiring nuclear weapons. It doesn't even mention its own obligation to get rid of nuclear weapons under the NPT. It is so regressive compared, for example, to the Hans Blix-led Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission that put out its report in 2006 and says that nuclear disarmament and non-proliferation have to be put on an equal footing if we are going to make progress on either.
Amazing. Well, you got a lot in there, Jackie Gabasso. Again, thank you for coming in. Congratulations on the Sean McBride Peace Prize, very prestigious award for many, many years of hard work. How can people get more information about your stuff?
Well, thank you very much. Our website is www.wslfweb.org.
Thank you, Jackie.
You're very welcome.
So the concept is this, basically. The whole black nation has to be put together as a black army. And we're going to walk on this nation. We're going to walk on this racist power structure. And we're going to say to the whole damn government, stick them up. This is a hold up. We come for what's ours.
Yo, black, it's time to set stage and guidelines. 10-point program, freeze a genocide round. A posse to protect the people and regulate and keep straight the man. Clear the way for P-Dog, the militant. Made to steer and care for the indigent. Power to the people is a serious concept. Panthers prowl when I say the step. Pigs today will end up like Frey. Like hunting, I'm never letting them get in my way. Soul on ice, what I won't be played like. Pigs and house niggas are setting my sight. Cock the gap back to be the pro-black. Arm the harm and alarm with the format. News going out to a racist cop. What? First mother steps up, get shot. The Phantom power. Step up but not to step back. Too full grown to allow a gang move. Step to the dog and I show and prove. 10-point program jams the flow and pigs in.
You are listening to POCC Block Report Radio with the Minister of Information, JR. Today we will be talking to one of the Bob Marleys of hip-hop, who many know from classic hits like Dig It, Santa Rita Weekend, Fat Cats and Bigger Fish, A Pimp Named Jesus, The Stand, Tiffany Hall, and many others. Boots of the political rap group The Coup. Boost, can you give the people a little bit of history of how you got into rapping personally, as well as a quick history of your group, The Coup, and how you guys, when you guys started and some of the highlights of your career, you know?
Yeah, well, I started out as a youth organizer and was in a couple organizations that were revolutionary, considered themselves revolutionary. And that was from the time that I was 14 and 15. And I decided to get involved in the culture that was affecting all of us as a way to put out the ideas that I was already putting out. By 19, and I didn't know what I was doing, got things together, studied how to put the lyrics down, studied how to do the music and practiced it. Got a little bit better at a time, put out an EP in 91 that was just called the EP. By 93, we put out our first nationally distributed album that was called Kill My Landlord. 95, we put out Genocide and Juice. 90, $8.99, somewhere around there. We put out Steal This Album, 2001, 2002. I'm just saying that because it's at the end of it, and there was a lot of problems a lot of people know about. We put out Party Music, and then in 2006, we put out Pick a Bigger Weapon.
What motivated your lyrics? What made you always be a political artist? As far as I've known you and known of your career, even before I personally known you, you've had a political, not just a political, but a revolutionary message. Not that message of a spectator who's reporting, but somebody who actively talking about organizing and getting involved and organizing right there on the level of the people, not speaking just from the podium or nothing like that. What motivated that, and what, you know, is that how you see yourself?
Well, I try to make my, even just as an artist, if I just want to look at myself as an artist, I want to make my art as relevant as possible. And you can't do that by only looking from the outside, because then you don't grasp, you know, all the finer elements of it. You understand the slogans, but you don't understand why there's the slogans in the first place. And so, even if I was just to look at it as an artist, to make my music more relevant, I have to be involved with stuff. Now, the reality is that I didn't start just with the idea of being an artist. I started figuring out how to be an artist in order to express myself better. And that's just, you know, my motive in life is to be involved and be part of some sort of change, figure out how I can more effectively be that. And be part of that. And right now it's through mainly doing music, and I've been involved in organizations and campaigns, and it's a struggle to figure out how to balance everything that comes with being an artist and trying to be able to make a living off of it, while at the same time trying to keep involved with everything going on. It's a struggle that I've always dealt with. At times, I've done less organizing and more music. At other times, I've done no music and all organizing. You know, it's something that I'm still trying to figure out. And, you know, so that's basically the thing. You know, I am who I am, and it's a whole person. I'm not just somebody that has ideas. My ideas are based on what I'm involved in.
Who are some of your political influences, and who are some of your musical influences, and what is, if there are any other influences that influence the configuration known as the coup?
Well, a model for and someone being an artist and being involved in the struggle to in the class struggle, let's say, I would say one model for that is Paul Robeson. Another model from the labor movement would be Joe Hill, who was kind of like the first rock star, because he went around singing labor songs before they weren't even recording them. But he made songs that people used in their day-to-day struggles, that they used in their rallies. Now, those are artists, and those are general ideas. They don't necessarily influence the aesthetic of what I do. They don't influence the style. But politically, I would say definitely growing up in Oakland, the Black Panther Party would have to be, you know, one of the main influences. Even though me getting politicized and becoming an organizer was from a group that wasn't, you know, along those lines. At the time when I learned about them, they definitely got me hyped about what I was doing, right? Even though that was the 80s and the Panthers were the 60s, and it seemed even more like ancient history then than it does to me now. It made me, the fact that they were Black and that they were organizing around trying to turn this system over, and especially that they were from Oakland. And they had a class line that definitely was one of the biggest influences. So, and more so how they involved the community than any one particular person. There are other struggles that definitely influence me from other countries, you know, and they're the predictable ones, and I talk about them in my music. So the other thing musically that who affected me, would definitely, one of the biggest ones would be Prince, Parliament Funkadelic. You know, those are two of the most obvious ones when you listen to my music. Other ones that are less obvious are, you know, some of the more pop rock sort of folks, you know, because I'm a fan of a good song. You know, I, in my music, I don't just try to say an idea. I try to put it together in a song format. What I mean by that is, you know, I think when I first started, I just want to put these ideas out while at the same time impressing people that I could be a raw rapper. And it wasn't as much about a song that spoke to one particular thing, as it was about, you know, getting people that are fans of lyricism into it. But right now, I'm into figuring out how to craft those ideas into a form that can affect someone to move in a certain way and that can make people relate to my feelings and my emotions about those things.
I know that you're involved with, you and Tom Morello have a group. Can you talk a little bit about your work with one of the members of Rage Against the Machine?
Yeah, me and Tom Morello formed a band called Street Sweeper. We recorded the album this year, and it will be out somewhere, hopefully around March, April of 2009. Tom did the music. You know, he came up with all the riffs, came up with all the music. It sounds like, you know, the riffs that you hear him playing on a lot of the other stuff. Of course, it's catered a little bit to my flow, and it's a little bit funkier maybe, but it's still, you know, it's kind of like a funk rock thing. And it's me doing all the vocals and all the lyrics, you know, so.
How did you guys hook up? What was like, you know, how did you guys get together and how did you decide what kind of content you guys wanted to make? Or did you guys just get in there and freak it and just, you knew what each other did?
Well, no, he sent me a cassette tape of a whole bunch of stuff with him playing riffs on acoustic guitar. And I tried for a few months to write something to it. But again, it was just him solo on acoustic guitar on a cassette tape because he didn't know how to make an MP3 or record on a CD or stuff like that. So I played with that. Then I was like, no, we got to get in the studio and do this how it's going to sound. So I had that to go with. So then once we went in the studio and recorded it more in a more finished form, then I went back and wrote everything. So it was kind of like I went back and wrote everything, then we got back in the studio and laid it all down.
So it's done?
Yeah, it's done. It will, like I said, I don't have a release date for it, but I've been told somewhere around March or April, and we'll start leaking stuff probably in January.
For those that are just tuning in, you are listening to the voice of the veteran frontman of the political rap group, The Coup. We are talking to Boots. This is the Minister of Information, JR, Black Report Radio. Boots, can you talk a little bit about how you feel about Obama being selected?
Well, I think that it says, there's two things that it says. One thing that mainly speaks to me is about where the people are at. Why people were so moved to go there. You know, they didn't go there for Jesse Jackson. They didn't go there for Kerry. They didn't do it. What's going on in the world that's making everybody say, I need something different? And why did they choose voting for Obama as the way to say that they need something different? And I say, and to go backwards, the reason they chose voting for Obama is the way to say something different, because we, who are the ones that are kind of holding this movement up, have not figured out, have not made our movement mass enough or tangible enough for everybody to grab onto. Everybody wants a drastic change in the system. So even, you know, rednecks in Alabama, while I was on tour, I heard them yelling to each other. One time it was like they was at some bar. Boy, you better vote for Obama, you know. And that's because people want to change. Our movement is not stifled from the lack of people wanting change. We have not matched up what the people want and into capturing their imagination. The thing is that Obama is not the person that's going to bring the change that everyone wants. While it is symbolic that he was voted in because people want something different, we know that for the past 130 years, at the very least, just that I can name off, none of the changes that have affected people in the ways that are material in their lives have come from electing someone into office. Even if you want to talk about things like affirmative action and the civil rights legislation, that happened because there was mass movement on the streets. They were scared of everything getting all the way turned over because there were people stopping industry from moving, hitting them in the pocketbook, not just from boycotts, because we know boycotts really can't, you know, really historically haven't shown to do a whole lot. The thing that works is labor stoppages and labor organizing. And by labor, I mean, and I don't mean just the picture of labor that we see now, which is the unions. I mean the people that create the wealth, which are us, which are the folks that work at McDonald's, the folks that work at Walmart, folks that, you know, are starving and trying to make money every day. When by those folks organizing and stopping that profit, that's when change has happened historically. But I do see this. I see the fact that people have come out and said in some way that I want change, and this is how I'm choosing to express that those of us who consider ourselves organizers, whether they consider themselves revolutionary or I just want things to change just a little bit, we have to jump on that signal and not alienate people by being like, this is just not the answer, because it's not the answer. But how do we take that, instead of pushing people down, lift them up to where they're ready to organize for something much greater, ready to organize for change in a way that is actually possible. Is Obama going to bring change? Everybody who listens to Flashpoints, include which I am one of them, knows some of the connections that he has to the ruling class and to the status quo. Do I know the future? Is he going to make some changes? I'm sure that he is different than George W. Bush, but the question is how different, you know. Do we want it? How different do we want it? And are we going to leave it to waiting to see what he does? Or are we going to force the hand of whoever's in power by making a movement that shows our power?
You recently did an interview with political prisoner, Black Panther, prolific writer Mumia Abu-Jamal. Can you talk a little bit about what motivated you to walk into the studio and do it? And how did you feel the interview came out? And, you know, and what are some of your afterthoughts?
Well, what motivated me to come into the studio and do it is this dude, JR, kept hitting me on the phone and the text saying, you want to come interview Mumia. But besides that, exactly like you said, his writing is prolific, and not only is it prolific, it's profound and it's beautiful. He is able to do what I said I was trying to do with my music, which is not just state the facts, but touch people while I'm stating the facts and stir some movement inside them that makes them want to be part of some change. And, so it was an honor to interview him.
How do you feel the interview came out, and what were your thoughts on Mumia based on the short conversation y'all had?
I think that the interview came out okay. I listened to it, and I don't remember if that's how it went down or it was just edited real well. But, I think that if I can recall exactly what was said in the interview, I think that he's a very sharp person. He's a sharp intellect, and we need his voice out there even more.
No doubt. Can you give the people any contact information that you may have in terms of a MySpace where they can hear more of what you might be doing with Tom Morello? I know if they want to see you, they can see you right here in the Bay Area at the Fillmore in San Francisco this December 7th. Buy your tickets now. But can you tell the people online or, you know, how else they can get up with you and see what you guys got going on, what the coup got going on?
Well, with the coup, it's myspace.com/thecoupmusic. And you can get all the dates and hear a little bit of music if you're not familiar. Street Sweeper, which is the project with Tom Morello, that's I kind of don't control when that's coming out or anything like that, but I've been told no music is to be leaked out. The only way that you'll be able to hear it. So there is no MySpace right now. There is no website right now. Some, of course, Rage Against the Machines fans have gone and made like little websites about it. And somebody made a Wikipedia page and things like that. But we did preview one of the songs during his last tour this past month. And so there's some YouTube of one of the songs. And you have to kind of, because we were just working it out, not with the full band that Street Sweeper is going to be, but with his band that was touring with him. And so we'll you can look on YouTube, scour YouTube and see. I think the song that we did is called 100 Little Curses.
Right on, Boost. Thank you for coming through, bro. And, man, a salute to you and your work, man.
Thank you very much.
All right. You were just listening to the voice of Boots, the frontman for the political rap group The Coup, on Block Report Radio with the Minister of Information, JR. For more info on the Block Report, you can check out www.blockreportradio.com. We out.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our interim technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Amanda Bellerby is our environmental producer and also produces the weekly Best of Flashpoints. To comment on today's program or to subscribe to our Fight Back email list, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. You can look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening. Music breaks: Odetta, If I Had a Hammer, by Pete Seeger, David Rovics, Hiroshima, and Paris, Panther Power. I'm Amanda Bellerby for Flashpoints.